Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Hide and Seek by Denver Murphy, narrated by Chris McDonnell. Prologue. The hotel room may have been unfamiliar to DCI Stella Johnson when she awoke, but she immediately knew where she was and how she had come to be there. The drugs provided by the staff at the hospital were still helping to numb her physical pain, but nothing could dull the anguish she was experiencing. A mere 48 hours ago, she had never felt more alive, being tantalizingly close to winning the 2 prizes she coveted most. In apprehending the serial killer who had been terrorizing communities across the country, she would have passed the greatest challenge in her career and could then focus on what she had been denying herself all this time. McNeil. When news of the first stabbing in Nottingham reached the station, Johnson had been forced to collect someone from uniform to accompany her to interview their initial suspect. P.C. McNeil, still relatively new to the force and many years her junior, was only meant to be a make-weight. He was to be seen but not heard. And yet, long before she saw anything romantic there, it was clear he had the makings of a good detective. When it became clear that they weren't just dealing with a one-off incident, she came to rely on McNeil's assistance. More than just an effective sounding board, his natural instincts were strong, and he had helped to stop her near-obsessive need to catch the killer from becoming too unorthodox in approach. But that was until their quarry made the mistake of trying too hard to cover up a murder in which he had failed to take his actions to a new level of depravity. Reverting back to his preferred method of stabbing his victims in the street, the man Johnson now knew to be former Detective Superintendent Jeffrey Brandt had fooled everyone except her. Determined to use this to her advantage, she had sought to draw him out through a scurrilous newspaper article. McNeil only found out about her plan when he read the morning headlines, not only illustrating that she knew she had been crossing the line with this strategy, but also meaning that she was solely responsible for what happened next. Casting aspersions of a sexual nature did bring Brandt out into the open, but not in the way she had expected. He had lain in wait for her outside the police station and had followed her home, with the intention of demonstrating to his accuser firsthand that he was neither confused as to his sexuality nor was he unable to become physically aroused by women. Having punched Johnson into unconsciousness at her front door, he had stripped her and tied her to her bed. But the knowledge that he had ultimately been unsuccessful didn't bring the slightest shred of comfort to Johnson as she stared at her hotel room ceiling. She didn't know why McNeil had chosen to come around to her house that night, but there was no denying that they had become more than just colleagues. The thought that he had been unable to respect her calls for patience only served to cause Johnson more pain. The feelings he had developed for her, feelings that she had nurtured and cultivated, may have ended up saving her, but in so doing, McNeil had paid the ultimate price. Chapter 1. The sight of McNeil holding up the knife that only a moment ago was buried in his chest caused the screams of protest to die in Johnson's throat. She continued to stare at him as he delicately placed it in her hands. She didn't want it. All she wanted was him. Allowing it to drop onto the bed, she grasped his hand instead. His look of regret was replaced with a smile, but it soon faded along with their connection, despite Johnson clutching him with all her might. His eyes remained steady but were no longer focused on her. Fear overcame her once more, and the screaming recommenced. Johnson didn't want to let go of McNeil, as though the very act would cause him to be lost. The calls for him to wake up mutated into unintelligible screeching, a sound so alien that it endangered her sanity. But amidst the wild panic, there remained a single shred of coherence. If he were to be saved, she would need help. Releasing his hand and severing their physical bond was the hardest thing she had ever done. With her grip now free, she frantically scrabbled around, horrified that the knife might have fallen to the floor. So relieved was she to feel the metal blade that she grabbed it, cutting herself in the process. Working her fingers along to the hilt, she contorted her wrist in an attempt to hack her bonds. She missed, and the jarring of metal upon metal as she gouged the wrought iron bed frame almost caused the knife to slip out of her slick palm. Gripping it to the extent that she heard her knuckles crack, she tried again, and with a few rough strokes her hand became free. Fighting the pins and needles in her arm, she managed to twist herself, allowing her to tackle the other side. Johnson relied on her core strength to haul herself up into a sitting position, so she could attend to her feet, not caring that her desperate slashes left gashes on her ankles. Resisting the urge to leap from the bed and sweep McNeil up in her embrace, she made her way unsteadily to the door, using the wall for support. Desperation drove her on, and despite her injuries, she took the stairs two at a time. With only thoughts of McNeil in her mind, the body spread across the floor at the bottom nearly caused her to lose her balance as she abruptly came to a halt. Before her was the man responsible for this atrocity, lying in a pool of his own blood. A wave of revulsion surged through her, only to be replaced by pride that McNeil had risked his life to save her. She wondered why he had come to her house, given they had agreed to part for the evening, and remembered her appeal in the police station car park for him to be patient and to allow their investigation to take precedence. The knowledge that their relationship would be unprofessional mixed with her usual sense of panic that she was letting someone into her life. She cursed herself for refusing to deal with the strength of her feelings. She had known he liked her, but had been scared that it was merely a crush on an older woman. If him choosing to come around, despite what she had said, was not enough to convince her otherwise, then what he did upstairs so willingly and tenderly showed she had been wrong to fear her feelings. Thoughts of McNeil's sacrifice served to rouse Johnson from her regrets and focus on the immediate. She wanted revenge for all the pain and suffering this disgusting creature in front of her had caused. It mattered not that he was dead. She would derive satisfaction from repeatedly slamming her bare heel onto his skull until it was crushed beyond all recognition. The nakedness he had inflicted on her would no longer be part of his act of degradation. Disrobed, she would be better able to revel in her obliteration of his physical form. But that would have to wait. McNeil was all that mattered, and she would resist her primeval need for retribution in order to save him. Carefully stepping over the body to avoid slipping in the dark pool of blood that glistened in the evening light, she scouted round for her handbag, silently cursing its absence. Knowing that she was wasting precious seconds, Johnson rushed into the sitting room to retrieve the house phone from its charging point. Despite her line of work, this was the first time she had dialed 999 and was initially confused when her call was answered by an operator asking which service she required. Acknowledging the priority, she demanded an ambulance. When this was met with an inquiry as to the nature of the emergency, she found herself ranting about a serial killer and her boyfriend lying stabbed upstairs. Whatever she said must have worked, because the calm and professional tone that had greeted her was now alarmed, but managing to inform her that a medical team had been dispatched using the address her number was linked to. Johnson was told she would need to hold the line whilst being transferred to the police. "Just fucking get them here," she shouted, throwing the handset down without ending the call. She needed to get back upstairs. The thought of McNeil just lying there, injured and alone, was unbearable, and dizziness threatened to collapse her. She grasped the mantelpiece and tried to bring her breathing under control. As well as her vision, she could feel her sense of logic begin to restore and recognized that she would need to be able to open the front door if she didn't want to risk having to leave McNeil again when the ambulance arrived. It was with this intention that she exited the sitting room, only to be met with a rush of air and added brightness, signalling someone already had. Chapter 2. There is a sound that punctuates the nothingness. faint at first but gradually building until it becomes unmistakable. Screams. Are they his own? That would certainly account for the pain he is feeling, but, as they continue, they don't sound like him. He should open up his eyes and get up, but he's afraid. Not just of whatever is making that inhuman screeching. He also senses that the pain is only going to intensify if he allows his body to fully regain consciousness. He has an overwhelming urge to give in to the temptation to slip under again, where there is no sound, no feeling, just warm, blissful oblivion. He must have. He can no longer hear anything. But even if it were not for the physical discomfort he is experiencing, he shouldn't be thinking anything now. The decision whether to wake or sleep remains. His body is demanding that it is allowed time to rest and repair, but his mind is telling him he is in danger. He doesn't know what from, and if it has anything to do with the owner of those screams. His mind is fractured, though, with another part of it imploring him to fade away and abandon an agony that goes far beyond whatever injuries he has just sustained. Just hold on, I'll get help. It isn't so much the words themselves that end the conflict within his immobile form, but the tremendous power and intent with which they are delivered. The part of him that warns against returning to a life of misery must be wrong, because this voice conveys a love that can conquer all obstacles. He will hold on to that and wait for the assistance that will follow. Whether it is just moments or hours later is unclear, for time is different where he currently resides. That voice has returned, but it being nearer isn't the only difference. The desperation remains, but the warmth has gone. She, for it is now undoubtedly female, is shouting about an attack. Has he been attacked? Is that why he is here? He can't believe that she is the cause of his pain, not when she spoke to him with such passion. They must know each other, a fact confirmed by the familiarity of the voice. Is she his wife? He vaguely remembers being married, but can't identify her name or anything about her. Just fucking get them here! The change in tone fully wakened Brandt. He knew exactly who it belonged to, and the immediate, massive dump of adrenaline in his system opened his eyes. Ignoring the thudding in his head, he rose to his feet. He started to move in her direction, but paused as he slipped and nearly lost his balance. Beneath him was an alarmingly large pool of blood, and an instinctive raise of his hand to the back of his head revealed it was his. The pain from earlier returned and multiplied. He didn't know where his knife was, and he understood that the help Johnson had promised was going to be in the form of the authorities. Brandt turned towards the door and flung it open. Greeted by the cool evening air, it refreshed his face and brought a welcome hit of oxygen. He banished the idea that he should stay and finish the job, and stumbled onto the front pathway and out of the gate. If he could just make it to his car and get away from here, he could give his body the respite it was demanding. He had no idea of the response times in this area, but if the police believed she was still in danger, they would rush here as quickly as possible. But the risk of capture was no longer his immediate concern. The noise from behind caused him to look around, and he staggered to the side and into a parked car. Johnson, naked except for a small pair of black panties, was flying out of her front door. The sight terrified him, and there was no notion of standing his ground. There was a savagery to her features that added to the shrieking, and Brandt was certain that should she catch him, he would be torn limb from limb. He pushed himself upright, not noticing that it was her car that had saved him from falling, and lurched the final few meters to his own vehicle. With the distance between them closing the whole time, it was only the fact that he hadn't locked his door that saved Brandt. He pulled it open as Johnson rounded the bonnet, and seeing the hatred and fury in her eyes, he swung his feet into the car before she ran into the door without slowing her pace. She bounced off it, the effect of which caused it to slam shut. Brandt immediately reached to lock it before she could start yanking on the handle. He still hadn't retrieved the key from his pocket, but his more immediate concern was the car's lack of central locking. He reached across to secure the passenger side, but was stopped by the loud thud from his own window. He turned and looked in horror to see Johnson's arm pulled back to make another attempt to smash the glass. Brandt could hear his own screams as a rock, clutched by her fist, slammed inches from his face. The smear of blood left from cuts on her hand stirred him into action once more. Overwhelming relief at not only finding the key immediately upon thrusting his hand into his pocket, but also managing to pull it out and insert it into the ignition without dropping it, was abruptly ended by Johnson's next swing disintegrating the window. Brandt was showered with glass an instant before her bloodied hand reached in to claw at his features. Instinctively turning his head away from the danger, he roared in pain as her nails dug at the wound from earlier. Twisting the key, he heard the familiar sound of the starter motor turning over but failing to fire, soon to be drowned out by Johnson's screams. Her claws had turned into fists once more, and she was now punching his head. The sustained shocks to his brain were causing his vision to close, and Brandt knew he wouldn't be able to withstand her fury much longer. It was only when the punches stopped that he realized the engine had somehow caught and was now idling roughly. He risked turning his face to look at Johnson, whose expression revealed the dawning horror that he may escape. He slammed it into first gear, looked up and saw her throw herself on the bonnet and use the windscreen wipers to prevent herself falling off. The car in front was parked close to him, and without the aid of power steering, he caught the blue Fiesta as he attempted to pull out into the road. The contact wasn't sufficient to dislodge Johnson, who not only remained on the bonnet, but was repositioning herself so she could hold on with her left hand, freeing her right to attack the windscreen. Brandt doubted she would be able to break through, but wasn't prepared to find out. With her fist now raised, he decided against changing gear and built up more speed. With the engine bouncing off the rev limiter, he slammed on the middle pedal instead. At that moment he fully intended to dislodge Johnson and then proceed to drive over her. But what his pikey piece of shit car gave with one hand by starting, it took with the other. The unnerving but now familiar sensation of the uneven brakes making the car lurch to the right as the wheels locked did cause Johnson to be thrown from the vehicle but across to the other side of the road. Now stationary, Brandt would have to back up if he was going to find the angle necessary to hit her. As he automatically checked his rearview mirror before putting the car in reverse, he could see the blue of flashing lights in the murky gloom of dusk behind him. Even the few seconds it would take to complete his maneuver might be enough for him to be spotted. Reluctantly placing the lever back in first, he resisted the temptation to see if he might manage enough steering lock to get her, knowing that a car pitching to the other side of the road would be far more noticeable, and notwithstanding the immediate danger that would place him in, the last thing he wanted was to point out where Johnson lay. As he took off up the road, he hoped that the impact of the hard tarmac on her soft, naked body had been enough to finish the job. Chapter 3. The shrill ringtone woke DSI Franklin with a start. The room appeared different from when he had first slumped on his sofa, the bright late spring sunshine having been replaced by night. Although his hangover remained, it was far less potent than before, and he didn't regret making the excuse to leave the office early so he could return home. Not yet, anyway.
"Boss, where are you?"
"I'm out in the field following up a lead."
Detective Superintendent Franklin knew that his team only respected him because of his position of authority. Much as they tried to hide it, the slight shaking of heads and unwitting roll of eyes that greeted a number of his key decisions revealed this. Other people with his status may not have noticed, much less cared, but it was his emotional intelligence that had got him so far. His police work had been solid at best, but he'd risen through the ranks from an ability to be in the right place at the right time, as well as a willingness to seek credit for the actions of others. It was only natural when a superior moved on for there to be some jockeying for position, but Franklin had maintained an advantage by anticipating things long before they happened. He liked to build up networks of contacts so that he could sense the way the wind was blowing, well in advance of a decision being made. He had become skilled at knowing the right time to brown-nose certain people and when to disassociate himself from others. Even with his retirement looming, he still longed for one final step up. It wasn't just that being DSI wasn't sufficiently elevated to satisfy his ambitions. The position itself was an awkward balancing act between managing those on the ground and fulfilling the demands from above. If he could just join the top brass, then he wouldn't have to deal directly with pricks like DC Pulford calling him. Instead, he would only then have to harry DSIs, in much the way he had been badgered over the years. Demanding results would be much easier than having to deliver them. But try as he might, and despite using every political trick he had honed over his career, he had been unsuccessful in getting that leg up. Whereas some of the DSIs whom he had befriended walked into promotions after only a token year or two in the job, and worse still, others refused requests for them to apply, Franklin had always found himself blocked. He knew his increasing frustration at having to remain in a post that he neither wanted nor was particularly good at was a contributing factor in the breakdown of his marriage. It wasn't the sole cause, and when his wife had confessed to falling out of love with him, it shouldn't have come as such a shock, given he had never loved her in the first place. He had approached relationships in the same calculated way as his career. By his early 30s, he felt that having a family would give the impression of stability and dependability, allowing him to adorn his desk with the sort of photos that his superiors felt necessary to demonstrate their humanity whilst delivering tough decisions. Franklin had chosen his partner carefully, neither attractive enough to be considered a trophy wife and provoke jealousy from others, nor sufficiently unappealing as to lower his credibility among the men of the force. That she was career-driven helped because the additional money had come in handy, and it meant she didn't complain about his long hours. They had taken expensive holidays together and had been able to send their two children to independent school. But with them growing up and more interested in social media than having a conversation with their father, and Franklin using alcohol more frequently to anesthetize him from the increasingly frustrating days at work, he and his wife had grown apart. What he needed was one high-profile case, one that was firmly rooted in the public domain, where the credit he would take for cracking it would make his next application impossible to ignore. Perhaps then he could focus on winning his wife back and spend his retirement learning how to love her. Franklin had observed the events unfolding in Nottinghamshire with a growing sense of injustice, which only intensified when the murderer decided to move on to Kent. When it finally came to his patch, he could barely conceal his delight. Not only was it all over the national newspapers, but his solving of something two other constabularies had failed to do was certain to see the top brass begging for him to join them. Except he hadn't been able to solve it. The attack in Milton Keynes appeared as random as the others. "Look, what is it?" he demanded grumpily. "There's been another attack." Franklin didn't need to know who the caller was referring to. "Here?" "No, Gov, back in Nottingham." "Fuck!" He had known the DSI there for a number of years, and knew he played with a straight bat. He would follow protocol and share the necessary information, but Franklin didn't like that the limelight would be shifting back to him. He'd very much enjoyed taking the central position in the recent press conference, and had viewed Potter playing second fiddle as handing him the baton. "When? I need details. If you were here, you would know that..." "You mind your tone. I've already told you that I'm following up something important." Franklin made a mental note to ensure that Pulford's next leave request found some spurious reason not to be granted. Perhaps an office reshuffle that saw him moved to just outside the toilets would also be in order. "Sorry, Gov," Pulford said, without sounding even the least bit remorseful. "Is it the guy from the email?" "What?"
Franklin had no idea what he was referring to. You know, the image of the suspect we were sent earlier.
Yes, that's the one.
He didn't like how unconvincing he sounded, and although he still needed the details from Pulford, he knew he should end this call as soon as possible.
Look, I'm just finishing up here. I'll be with you in half an hour.
He hung up without waiting for reply, in a petulant attempt to reassert his authority. Franklin immediately opened his work emails on his phone. As soon as he found what the hell Pulford was going on about, he would jump in his car and get back to the station. He might even call Potter on his way to see if he could get the information straight from the horse's mouth. It would also serve as a reminder that he wasn't going to be cut out of the loop on this one. There it was, at the bottom of the list of all the various messages he had been sent over the past few hours. He didn't bother reading the contents and went straight for the attached image. His mouth opened to laugh at the grainy CCTV-derived still, so indistinct as to demonstrate the desperation on the part of those who sent it. But no sound emerged from Franklin. Even on the small screen of his smartphone, there was no doubt in his mind who this person was. It was Jeff. It was his friend and colleague of many years, former Detective Superintendent Jeffrey Brandt.
"Fucking hell," Franklin whispered.
With his mind unable to process the implications of what he had viewed, he reverted back to the body of the email. There it was in black and white. The man in the photo, having been seen on cameras around some of the locations, and at times consistent with when the murders had taken place, was wanted for questioning. Whilst Franklin remained certain that the image was undoubtedly of Brandt, he couldn't believe that his friend would somehow be involved. What was troubling him most was that he had been sent this hours earlier, and for him not to have noticed that it was the man whom he had spent the whole of the previous day with would, at the very least, make him seem incompetent.
Shit!
What made matters worse was that Franklin had just told D.C. Pulford that he had been following this up for the last few hours. He needed to think and to think fast. Perhaps if he could get to Brandt first, not only could he cover up his own mistake of leaving work early and not checking his messages, but by proving Nottingham had the wrong guy, he could discredit Potter's team in the process. A sound plan, and one that could see him coming out of this smelling of roses. A telephone conversation was likely to be awkward, and it wouldn't explain his lengthy absence from the office. He would need to go around to Brandt's house and talk to him, man to man. Quickly rushing into the kitchen to splash some water on his face and to sort out his hair, flattened at the back whilst he had been asleep, he grabbed his coat and headed out to his car. Chapter 4. Initially sure that either he or the car would fail on some part of the journey, it was with relief he arrived back in his hometown. Once Brandt had made it to the motorway, despite his head still throbbing, he spent the remainder of the time thinking through his options. There were many variables to consider, but the upside was it drove any drowsiness from his mind. The first thing of concern was whether he was in immediate danger. It felt like there was a more than even chance Johnson had survived her fall, and he was grateful that he had at no point shared his identity with her. However, he was troubled by the look she had given him when he first approached. Beneath the initial shock, he was sure there was some form of recognition, and no matter how much he tried to reassure himself that he must have misinterpreted her expression at a time of high emotion, he had learned long ago to trust his instincts. Nevertheless, even if for some reason she had recognized him, Brandt was sure she didn't know his name. If she did, it was game over anyway, because that would mean she also knew his address, and the police would be waiting for him back at his house. Even if it wasn't for the need to go home and collect his money, fleeing altogether now would clearly leave the issue of the car. It didn't matter that it was unlikely she noticed the number plate. A simple description of the vehicle, either by her or one of the neighbours, who must have been alerted by the commotion outside, would be sufficient. How long it would take to track would depend on the quality of the description and the proximity of the nearest camera. once they were able to establish...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?